Clipper Audio presents an unabridged recording of Mrs. Dalloway by Virginia Woolf, narrated by Virginia Leishman. This book is copyrighted 1953 by Leonard Woolf. This recording is copyrighted 2002 by Recorded Books. Like James Joyce's Ulysses, which Virginia Woolf read with great reluctance, her novel, Mrs. Dalloway, attempts to convey the intimate particulars of a single human consciousness over the course of one day. As Clarissa Dalloway prepares her house for a small party, her mind dips in and out of her life's course, grinding into the realities of its crueler occasions, war and loss, before bursting afresh with a sudden recall of some beautiful kindness or love, while smiles flicker in the brain and fade out at the memories of old jokes and friends. Communication is health, one of the characters thinks, and what Virginia Woolf tried to communicate for the wholeness of her reader's perception was the nature of the mind entire. One of the major literary figures of the 20th century, Virginia Woolf applied her experimental techniques to the rendering of human consciousness in such groundbreaking works as To the Lighthouse, Jacob's Room, and The Waves. When asked about her artistic intentions, Woolf wrote, "I have to create the whole thing afresh for myself each time. Probably all writers are in the same boat. It is the penalty we pay for breaking with tradition, and the solitude makes the writing more exciting, though the being read less so. One ought to sink to the bottom of the sea, probably, and live alone with one's words." Virginia Woolf committed suicide by drowning in 1941. And now, Mrs. Dalloway. Mrs. Dalloway, Disc 2.
"What are they looking at?" said Clarissa Dalloway to the maid who opened her door. The hall of the house was cool as a vault. Mrs. Dalloway raised her hand to her eyes, and as the maid shut the door too, and she heard the swish of Lucy's skirts, she felt like a nun who has left the world and feels fold round her the familiar veils and the response to old devotions. The cook whistled in the kitchen. She heard the click of the typewriter. It was her life, and bending her head over the hall table, she bowed beneath the influence, felt blessed and purified, saying to herself, as she took the pad with the telephone message on it, how moments like this are buds on the tree of life. Flowers of darkness they are, she thought, as if some lovely rose had blossomed for her eyes only. Not for a moment did she believe in God. But all the more, she thought, taking up the pad, must one repay in daily life to servants, yes, to dogs and canaries, above all to Richard, her husband, who was the foundation of it. Of the gay sounds, of the green lights, of the cook, even, whistling, for Mrs. Walker was Irish and whistled all day long. One must pay back from this secret deposit of exquisite moments, she thought, lifting the pad, while Lucy stood by her, trying to explain how. "Mr. Dalloway, ma'am," Clarissa read on the telephone pad, "Lady Bruton wishes to know if Mr. Dalloway will lunch with her today. Mr. Dalloway, ma'am, told me to tell you he would be lunching out." "Dear," said Clarissa, and Lucy shared, as she meant her to, her disappointment, but not the pang, felt the concord between them, took the hint, thought how the gentry love, gilded her own future with calm, and, taking Mrs. Dalloway's parasol, handled it like a sacred weapon which a goddess, having acquitted herself honourably in the field of battle, sheds, and placed it in the umbrella stand. "Fear no more," said Clarissa, "fear no more the heat of the sun. For the shock of Lady Bruton asking Richard to lunch without her made the moment in which she had stood shiver, as a plant on the riverbed feels the shock of a passing oar and shivers. So she rocked, so she shivered. Millicent Bruton, whose lunch parties were said to be extraordinarily amusing, had not asked her. No vulgar jealousy could separate her from Richard, but she feared time itself, and read on Lady Bruton's face, as if it had been a dial cut in impassive stone, the dwindling of life. How year by year her share was sliced, how little the margin that remained was capable any longer of stretching, of absorbing, as in the youthful years, the colours, salts, tones of existence, so that she filled the room she entered, and felt often as she stood hesitating one moment on the threshold of her drawing-room, an exquisite suspense, such as might stay a diver before plunging, while the sea darkens and brightens beneath him, and the waves which threaten to break, but only gently split their surface, roll and conceal and encrust as they just turn over the weeds with pearl. She put the pad on the hall table. She began to go slowly upstairs, with her hand on the banisters, as if she had left a party where now this friend, now that, had flashed back her face, her voice, had shut the door and gone out and stood alone, a single figure against the appalling night, or rather, to be accurate, against the stare of this matter-of-fact June morning. Soft with the glow of rose petals for some, she knew, and felt it as she paused by the open staircase window which let in blinds flapping, dogs barking. Let in, she thought, feeling herself suddenly shrivelled, aged, breastless, the grinding, blowing, flowering of the day, out of doors, out of the window, out of her body and brain, which now failed, since Lady Bruton, whose lunch parties were said to be extraordinarily amusing, had not asked her.
Mrs. Dalloway, Disc 3.
The grey nurse resumed her knitting as Peter Walsh, on the hot seat beside her, began snoring. In her grey dress, moving her hands indefatigably yet quietly, she seemed like the champion of the rights of sleepers, like one of those spectral presences which rise in twilight in woods made of sky and branches. The solitary traveller, haunter of lanes, disturber of ferns, and devastator of great hemlock plants, looking up, suddenly sees the giant figure at the end of the ride. By conviction an atheist, perhaps, he is taken by surprise with moments of extraordinary exaltation. Nothing exists outside us except a state of mind, he thinks, a desire for solace, for relief, for something outside these miserable pygmies, these feeble, these ugly, these craven men and women. But if he can conceive of her, then in some sort she exists, he thinks. And advancing down the path, with his eyes upon sky and branches, he rapidly endows them with womanhood, sees with amazement how grave they become, how majestically, as the breeze stirs them, they dispense with a dark flutter of the leaves, charity, comprehension, absolution, and then, flinging themselves suddenly aloft, confound the piety of their aspect with a wild carouse. Such are the visions which proffer great cornucopias full of fruit to the solitary traveller, or murmur in his ear like sirens lolloping away on the green sea waves, or are dashed in his face like bunches of roses, or rise to the surface like pale faces which fishermen flounder through floods to embrace. Such are the visions which ceaselessly float up, pace beside, put their faces in front of the actual thing, often overpowering the solitary traveller and taking away from him the sense of the earth, the wish to return, and giving him for substitute a general peace, as if, so he thinks as he advances down the forest ride, all this fever of living were simplicity itself, and myriads of things merged in one thing, and this figure, made of sky and branches as it is, had risen from the troubled sea. He is elderly, past 50 now, as a shape might be sucked up out of the waves to shower down from her magnificent hands compassion, comprehension, absolution. So, he thinks, may I never go back to the lamplight, to the sitting room, never finish my book, never knock out my pipe, never ring for Mrs. Turner to clear away. Rather, let me walk straight on to this great figure, who will, with a toss of her head, mount me on her streamers and let me blow to nothingness with the rest. Such are the visions. The solitary traveller is soon beyond the wood. And there, coming to the door with shaded eyes, possibly to look for his return, with hands raised, with white apron blowing, is an elderly woman who seems, so powerful is this infirmity, to seek over a desert a lost son, to search for a rider destroyed, to be the figure of the mother whose sons have been killed in the battles of the world. So, as the solitary traveller advances down the village street, where the women stand knitting and the men dig in the garden, the evening seems ominous, the figures still, as if some august fate, known to them, awaited without fear, were about to sweep them into complete annihilation. Indoors, among ordinary things, the cupboard, the table, the windowsill with its geraniums, suddenly the outline of the landlady, bending to remove the cloth, becomes soft with light, an adorable emblem which only the recollection of cold human contacts forbids us to embrace. She takes the marmalade. She shuts it in the cupboard. There's nothing more tonight, sir. But to whom does the solitary traveller make reply?
Mrs. Dalloway, Disc 4.
Something was up, Mr. Brewer knew. Mr. Brewer, managing clerk at Sibley's and Arrowsmith's, auctioneers, valuers, land and estate agents. Something was up, he thought. And being paternal with his young men, and thinking very highly of Smith's abilities, and prophesying that he would, in 10 or 15 years, succeed to the leather armchair in the inner room under the skylight with the deed boxes round him, if he keeps his health, said Mr. Brewer. And that was the danger. He looked weakly. Advised football, invited him to supper, and was seeing his way to consider recommending a rise of salary. When something happened which threw out many of Mr. Brewer's calculations, took away his ablest young fellows, and eventually, so prying and insidious were the fingers of the European war, smashed a plaster cast of Ceres, ploughed a hole in the geranium beds, and utterly ruined the cook's nerves at Mr. Brewer's establishment at Muswell Hill. Septimus was one of the first to volunteer. He went to France to save an England which consisted almost entirely of Shakespeare's plays and Miss Isabel Pole in a green dress walking in a square. There, in the trenches, the change which Mr. Brewer desired when he advised football was produced instantly. He developed manliness. He was promoted. He drew the attention, indeed the affection, of his officer, Evans by name. It was a case of two dogs playing on a hearthrug, one worrying a paper screw, snarling, snapping, giving a pinch now and then at the old dog's ear, the other lying somnolent, blinking at the fire, raising a paw, turning and growling good-temperedly. They had to be together, share with each other, fight with each other, quarrel with each other. But when Evans, Rachel, who had only seen him once, called him a quiet man, a sturdy, red-haired man, undemonstrative in the company of women. When Evans was killed, just before the armistice, in Italy, Septimus, far from showing any emotion or recognizing that here was the end of a friendship, congratulated himself upon feeling very little and very reasonably. The war had taught him. It was sublime. He had gone through the whole show, friendship, European war, death, had won promotion, was still under 30, and was bound to survive. He was right there. The last shells missed him. He watched them explode with indifference. When peace came, he was in Milan, billeted in the house of an innkeeper, with a courtyard, flowers in tubs, little tables in the open, daughters making hats. And to Lucrezia, the younger daughter, he became engaged one evening when the panic was on him, that he could not feel.
Mrs. Dalloway, Disc 6.
Rezia, sitting at the table, twisting a hat in her hands, watched him, saw him smiling. He was happy then, but she couldn't bear to see him smiling. It was not marriage. It was not being one's husband to look strange like that, always to be starting, laughing, sitting hour after hour silent, or clutching her and telling her to write. The table drawer was full of those writings, about war, about Shakespeare, about great discoveries, how there is no death. Lately he had become excited suddenly for no reason, and both Dr. Holmes and Sir William Bradshaw said excitement was the worst thing for him, and waved his hands and cried out that he knew the truth. He knew everything. That man, his friend who was killed, Evans, had come, he said. He was singing behind the screen. She wrote it down just as he spoke it. Some things were very beautiful, others sheer nonsense. And he was always stopping in the middle, changing his mind, wanting to add something, hearing something new, listening with his hand up. But she heard nothing. And once they found the girl who did the room reading one of these papers in fits of laughter. It was a dreadful pity, for that made Septimus cry out about human cruelty, how they tear each other to pieces. The fallen, he said, they tear to pieces. Holmes is on us, he would say, and he would invent stories about Holmes. Holmes eating porridge, Holmes reading Shakespeare, making himself roar with laughter or rage, for Dr. Holmes seemed to stand for something horrible to him. Human nature, he called him. Then there were the visions. He was drowned, he used to say, and lying on a cliff with the gulls screaming over him. He would look over the edge of the sofa, down into the sea. Or he was hearing music. Really, it was only a barrel organ or some man crying in the street. But lovely, he used to cry, and the tears would run down his cheeks, which was to her the most dreadful thing of all. To see a man like Septimus, who had fought, who was brave, crying. And he would lie listening until suddenly he would cry that he was falling down, down into the flames. Actually, she would look for flames, it was so vivid. But there was nothing. They were alone in the room. It was a dream, she would tell him, and so quiet him at last. But sometimes she was frightened, too. She sighed as she sat sewing.
Mrs. Dalloway, Disc 7.
Lucy came running full tilt downstairs, having just nipped into the drawing-room to smooth a cover, to straighten a chair, to pause a moment and feel whoever came in must think how clean, how bright, how beautifully cared for when they saw the beautiful silver, the brass fire-irons, the new chair-covers, and the curtains of yellow chintz. She appraised each. Heard a roar of voices. People already coming up from dinner. She must fly. The Prime Minister was coming, Agnes said. So she'd heard them say in the dining room, she said, coming in with a tray of glasses. Did it matter? Did it matter in the least? One Prime Minister, more or less. It made no difference at this hour of the night to Mrs. Walker, among the plates, saucepans, colanders, frying pans, chicken in aspic, ice cream freezers, paired crusts of bread, lemons, soup tureens and pudding basins, which, however hard they washed up in the scullery, seemed to be all on top of her, on the kitchen table, on chairs, while the fire blared and roared, the electric lights glared, and still supper had to be laid. All she felt was, One Prime Minister, more or less, made not a scrap of difference to Mrs. Walker. The ladies were going upstairs already, said Lucy. The ladies were going up, one by one, Mrs. Dalloway walking last, and almost always sending back some message to the kitchen. My love to Mrs. Walker. That was it one night. Next morning they would go over the dishes, the soup, the salmon. The salmon, Mrs. Walker knew, as usual, underdone, for she always got nervous about the pudding and left it to Jenny. So it happened the salmon was always underdone. But some lady with fair hair and silver ornaments had said, Lucy said, about the entree, was it really made at home? But it was the salmon that bothered Mrs. Walker, as she spun the plates round and round and pulled in dampers and pulled out dampers. And there came a burst of laughter from the dining-room. A voice speaking, then another burst of laughter. The gentlemen enjoying themselves when the ladies had gone. "The tokay," said Lucy, running in. "Mr. Dalloway had sent for the tokay from the Emperor's cellars, the Imperial tokay." It was borne through the kitchen. Over her shoulder, Lucy reported how Miss Elizabeth looked quite lovely. She couldn't take her eyes off her, in her pink dress, wearing the necklace Mr. Dalloway had given her. Jenny must remember the dog, Miss Elizabeth's fox terrier, which, since it bit, had to be shut up, and might, Elizabeth thought, want something. Jenny must remember the dog. But Jenny was not going upstairs with all those people about. There was a motor at the door already. There was a ring at the bell, and the gentleman still in the dining-room, drinking tokay. There, they were going upstairs. That was the first to come, and now they would come faster and faster, so that Mrs. Parkinson, hired for parties, would leave the hall door ajar, and the hall would be full of gentlemen waiting. They stood waiting, sleeking down their hair, while the ladies took their cloaks off in the room along the passage, where Mrs. Barnett helped them, old Ellen Barnett, who'd been with the family for 40 years, and came every summer to help the ladies, and remembered mothers when they were girls, and though very unassuming, did shake hands. Said milady very respectfully, yet had a humorous way with her, looking at the young ladies, and ever so tactfully helping Lady Lovejoy, who had some trouble with her underbodice. And they could not help feeling, Lady Lovejoy and Miss Alice, that some little privilege in the matter of brush and comb was awarded them, having known Mrs. Barnett. 30 years, milady, Mrs. Barnett supplied her. Mrs. Dalloway said she would buy the flowers herself, for Lucy had her work cut out for her. The doors would be taken off their hinges. Rumpelmeyer's men were coming. And then, thought Clarissa Dalloway, what a morning, fresh as if issued to children on a beach. What a lark! What a plunge! For so it had always seemed to her when, with a little squeak of the hinges, which she could hear now, she had burst open the French windows and plunged at Boughton into the open air. How fresh, how calm, stiller than this, of course, the air was in the early morning, like the flap of a wave, the kiss of a wave, chill and sharp, and yet, for a girl of 18 as she then was, solemn, feeling as she did, standing there at the open window, that something awful was about to happen. Looking at the flowers, at the trees with the smoke winding off them, and the rooks rising, falling. Standing and looking until Peter Walsh said, "Musing among the vegetables." Was that it? "I prefer men to cauliflowers." Was that it? He must have said it at breakfast one morning when she had gone out onto the terrace. Peter Walsh. He would be back from India one of these days, June or July, she forgot which, for his letters were awfully dull. It was his sayings one remembered, his eyes, his pocket knife, his smile, his grumpiness, and when millions of things had utterly vanished, how strange it was, a few sayings, like this about cabbages. She stiffened a little on the curb, waiting for Dirtnell's van to pass. A charming woman, Scrope Purvis thought her, knowing her as one does people who live next door to one in Westminster. A touch of the bird about her, of the jay, blue-green, light, vivacious, though she was over 50, and grown very white since her illness. There she perched, never seeing him, waiting to cross, very upright. For having lived in Westminster, how many years now? Over 20. One feels even in the midst of the traffic, or waking at night, Clarissa was positive, a particular hush or solemnity, an indescribable pause, a suspense, but that might be her heart, affected, they said, by influenza, before Big Ben strikes. There, out it boomed. First a warning, musical, then the hour, irrevocable. The leaden circles dissolved in the air. Such fools we are, she thought, crossing Victoria Street. For heaven only knows why one loves it so, how one sees it so, making it up, building it round one, tumbling it, creating it every moment afresh. But the veriest frumps, the most dejected of miseries, sitting on doorsteps, drink their downfall, do the same. Can't be dealt with, she felt positive, by Acts of Parliament for that very reason. They love life. In people's eyes, in the swing, tramp and trudge, in the bellow and the uproar, the carriages, motor cars, omnibuses, vans, sandwich men shuffling and swinging, brass bands, barrel organs, in the triumph and the jingle and the strange high singing of some aeroplane overhead was what she loved. Life. London. This moment of June. Like a nun withdrawing, or a child exploring a tower, she went upstairs, paused at the window, came to the bathroom. There was the green linoleum and a tap dripping. There was an emptiness about the heart of life, an attic room. Women must put off their rich apparel. At midday they must disrobe. She pierced the pincushion and laid her feathered yellow hat on the bed. The sheets were clean, tight stretched in a broad white band from side to side. Narrower and narrower would her bed be. The candle was half burnt down, and she had read deep in Baron Marbot's memoirs. She had read late at night of the retreat from Moscow. For the house sat so long that Richard insisted after her illness that she must sleep undisturbed. And really, she preferred to read of the retreat from Moscow. He knew it. So the room was an attic, the bed narrow. And lying there reading, for she slept badly, she could not dispel a virginity preserved through childbirth which clung to her like a sheet. Lovely in girlhood, suddenly there came a moment, for example on the river beneath the woods at Clevedon, when, through some contraction of this cold spirit, she had failed him. And then at Constantinople, and again. She could see what she lacked. It was not beauty, it was not mind. It was something central which permeated, something warm which broke up surfaces and rippled the cold contact of man and woman, or of women together. For that she could dimly perceive. She resented it, had a scruple picked up heaven knows where, or, as she felt, sent by nature, who is invariably wise. Yet she could not resist sometimes yielding to the charm of a woman, not a girl, of a woman confessing, as to her they often did, some scrape, some folly. And whether it was pity, or their beauty, or that she was older, or some accident, like a faint scent, or a violin next door, so strange is the power of sounds at certain moments, she did undoubtedly then feel what men felt. Only for a moment, but it was enough. It was a sudden revelation, a tinge like a blush which one tried to check, and then, as it spread, one yielded to its expansion, and rushed to the farthest verge, and there quivered, and felt the world come closer, swollen with some astonishing significance, some pressure of rapture which split its thin skin and gushed and poured with an extraordinary alleviation over the cracks and sores. Then, for that moment, she had seen an illumination, a match burning in a crocus, an inner meaning almost expressed. But the close withdrew, the hard softened. It was over, the moment. Against such moments, with women too, there contrasted, as she laid her hat down, the bed and Baron Marbot and the candle half burnt. Lying awake, the floor creaked. The lit house was suddenly darkened, and if she raised her head, she could just hear the click of the handle released as gently as possible by Richard, who slipped upstairs in his socks and then, as often as not, dropped his hot water bottle and swore. How she laughed! But this question of love, she thought, putting her coat away, this falling in love with women. Take Sally Seton, her relation in the old days with Sally Seton. Had not that, after all, been love? So the elderly nurse knitted over the sleeping baby in Regent's Park. So Peter Walsh snored. He woke with extreme suddenness, saying to himself, "The death of the soul." "Lord, Lord," he said to himself out loud, stretching and opening his eyes, "the death of the soul." The words attached themselves to some scene, to some room, to some past he had been dreaming of. It became clearer, the scene, the room, the past he had been dreaming of. It was at Boughton that summer, early in the 90s, when he was so passionately in love with Clarissa. There were a great many people there, laughing and talking, sitting around a table after tea, and the room was bathed in yellow light and full of cigarette smoke. They were talking about a man who had married his housemaid, one of the neighbouring squires. He had forgotten his name. He had married his housemaid, and she had been brought to Boughton to call. An awful visit it had been. She was absurdly overdressed. "Like a cockatoo," Clarissa had said, imitating her. And she never stopped talking. On and on she went, on and on. Clarissa imitated her. Then somebody said, Sally Seton it was, "Did it make any real difference to one's feelings to know that before they'd married she'd had a baby?" In those days, in mixed company, it was a bold thing to say. He could see Clarissa now, turning bright pink, somehow contracting, and saying, "Oh, I shall never be able to speak to her again." Whereupon the whole party sitting round the tea table seemed to wobble. It was very uncomfortable. He hadn't blamed her for minding the fact, since in those days a girl brought up as she was knew nothing. But it was her manner that annoyed him. Timid, hard, something arrogant, unimaginative, prudish. The death of the soul. He had said that instinctively, ticketing the moment as he used to do. The death of her soul. Everyone wobbled. Everyone seemed to bow as she spoke, and then to stand up different. He could see Sally Seton, like a child who has been in mischief, leaning forward, rather flushed, wanting to talk, but afraid. And Clarissa did frighten people. She was Clarissa's greatest friend, always about the place, totally unlike her, an attractive creature, handsome, dark, with the reputation in those days of great daring, and he used to give her cigars, which she smoked in her bedroom. She had either been engaged to somebody or quarrelled with her family, and old Parry disliked them both equally, which was a great bond. Then Clarissa, still with an air of being offended with them all, got up, made some excuse, and went off alone. As she opened the door, in came that great shaggy dog which ran after sheep. She flung herself upon him, went into raptures. It was as if she said to Peter, it was all aimed at him, he knew, "I know you thought me absurd about that woman just now, but see how extraordinarily sympathetic I am. See how I love my Rob." They had always this queer power of communicating without words. She knew directly he criticised her. Then she would do something quite obvious to defend herself, like this fuss with the dog. But it never took him in. He always saw through Clarissa. Not that he said anything, of course. Just sat looking glum. It was the way their quarrels often began. She shut the door. At once, he became extremely depressed. It all seemed useless, going on being in love, going on quarrelling, going on making it up. And he wandered off alone, among outhouses, stables, looking at the horses. The place was quite a humble one. The Parrys were never very well off. But there were always grooms and stable boys about. Clarissa loved riding. And an old coachman. What was his name? An old nurse. Old Moody. Old Goody. Some such name they called her. Whom one was taken to visit in a little room with lots of photographs. Lots of bird cages. It was an awful evening. He grew more and more gloomy. Not about that only. About everything. And he couldn't see her, couldn't explain to her, couldn't have it out. There were always people about. She'd go on as if nothing had happened. That was the devilish part of her, this coldness, this woodenness, something very profound in her, which he had felt again this morning, talking to her, an impenetrability. Yet, heaven knows, he loved her. She had some queer power of fiddling on one's nerves, turning one's nerves to fiddle strings, yes. For now that it was all over, truce signed and the dead buried, he had, especially in the evening, these sudden thunderclaps of fear. He could not feel. As he opened the door of the room where the Italian girls sat making hats, he could see them, could hear them. They were rubbing wires among coloured beads in saucers. They were turning buckram shapes this way and that. The table was all strewn with feathers, spangles, silks, ribbons. Scissors were rapping on the table. But something failed him. He could not feel. Still, scissors rapping, girls laughing, hats being made, protected him. He was assured of safety. He had a refuge. But he couldn't sit there all night. There were moments of waking in the early morning. The bed was falling. He was falling. Oh, for the scissors and the lamplight and the buckram shapes. He asked Lucrezia to marry him, the younger of the two, the gay, the frivolous, with those little artist's fingers that she would hold up and say, "It is all in them." Silk, feathers, what not, were alive to them. "It is the hat that matters most," she would say when they walked out together. Every hat that passed she would examine, and the cloak and the dress and the way the woman held herself. Ill-dressing, over-dressing, she stigmatized, not savagely, rather with impatient movements of the hands, like those of a painter who puts from him some obvious, well-meant, glaring imposture. And then, generously, but always critically, she would welcome a shop girl who had turned her little bit of stuff gallantly, or praise wholly, with enthusiastic and professional understanding, a French lady descending from her carriage in chinchilla, robes, pearls. "Beautiful," she would murmur, nudging Septimus that he might see. But beauty was behind a pane of glass. Even taste, Rezia liked ices, chocolates, sweet things, had no relish to him. He put down his cup on the little marble table. He looked at people outside. Happy, they seemed, collecting in the middle of the street, shouting, laughing, squabbling over nothing. But he could not taste. He could not feel. In the tea shop among the tables and the chattering waiters, the appalling fear came over him. He could not feel. He could reason. He could read Dante, for example, quite easily. "Septimus, do put down your book," said Rezia, gently shutting the inferno. He could add up his bill. His brain was perfect. It must be the fault of the world, then, that he could not feel. The English are so silent, Rezia said. She liked it, she said. She respected these Englishmen and wanted to see London and the English horses and the tailor-made suits, and could remember hearing how wonderful the shops were from an aunt who had married and lived in Soho. It might be possible, Septimus thought, looking at England from the train window as they left New Haven. It might be possible that the world itself is without meaning. Her sigh was tender and enchanting, like the wind outside a wood in the evening. Now she put down her scissors. Now she turned to take something from the table. A little stir, a little crinkling, a little tapping built up something on the table there where she sat sewing. Through his eyelashes he could see her blurred outline, her little black body, her face and hands, her turning movements at the table as she took up a reel or looked. She was apt to lose things, for her silk. She was making a hat for Mrs. Filmer's married daughter, whose name was... He'd forgotten her name. "What is the name of Mrs. Filmer's married daughter?" he asked. "Mrs. Peters," said Rezia. She was afraid it was too small, she said, holding it before her. Mrs. Peters was a big woman, but she did not like her. It was only because Mrs. Filmer had been so good to them. "She gave me grapes this morning," she said, that Rezia wanted to do something to show that they were grateful. She had come into the room the other evening and found Mrs. Peters, who thought they were out, playing the gramophone. "Was it true?" he asked. "She was playing the gramophone?" "Yes, she had told him about it at the time. She had found Mrs. Peters playing the gramophone." He began, very cautiously, to open his eyes to see whether a gramophone was really there. But real things were too exciting. He must be cautious. He would not go mad. First he looked at the fashion papers on the lower shelf, then, gradually, at the gramophone with the green trumpet. Nothing could be more exact. And so, gathering courage, he looked at the sideboard, the plate of bananas, the engraving of Queen Victoria and the Prince Consort, at the mantelpiece with the jar of roses. None of these things moved. All were still. All were real. "She is a woman with a spiteful tongue," said Rezia. "What does Mr. Peters do?" Septimus asked. "Ah," said Rezia, trying to remember. She thought Mrs. Filmer had said that he travelled for some company. "Just now he is in Hull," she said. "Just now," she said that with her Italian accent. She said that herself. He shaded his eyes so that he might see only a little of her face at a time, first the chin, then the nose, then the forehead, in case it were deformed or had some terrible mark on it. But no, there she was, perfectly natural, sewing, with the pursed lips that women have, the set, the melancholy expression when sewing. But there was nothing terrible about it, he assured himself, looking a second time, a third time, at her face, her hands, for what was frightening or disgusting in her, as she sat there in broad daylight, sewing? Mrs. Peters had a spiteful tongue. Mr. Peters was in Hull. Why then rage and prophesy? Why fly scourged and outcast? Why be made to tremble and sob by the clouds? Why seek truths and deliver messages when Rezia sat sticking pins into the front of her dress and Mr. Peters was in Hull? Miracles, revelations, agonies, loneliness, falling through the sea, down, down into the flames, all were burnt out. For he had a sense, as he watched Rezia trimming the straw hat for Mrs. Peters, of a coverlet of flowers. "Young ladies did not use to rouge," said Lady Lovejoy, "when they stayed at Boughton in the old days." "And Miss Alice didn't need rouge," said Mrs. Barnett, looking at her fondly. There Mrs. Barnett would sit, in the cloakroom, patting down the furs, smoothing out the Spanish shawls, tidying the dressing table, and knowing perfectly well, in spite of the furs and the embroideries, which were nice ladies, which were not. "The dear old body," said Lady Lovejoy, mounting the stairs. "Clarissa's old nurse." And then Lady Lovejoy stiffened. "Lady and Miss Lovejoy," she said to Mr. Wilkins, hired for parties. He had an admirable manner as he bent and straightened himself, and announced with perfect impartiality, "Lady and Miss Lovejoy, Sir John and Lady Needham, Miss Weld, Mr. Walsh." His manner was admirable. His family life must be irreproachable, except that it seemed impossible that a being with greenish lips and shaven cheeks could ever have blundered into the nuisance of children. "How delightful to see you," said Clarissa. She said it to everyone. "How delightful to see you." She was at her worst, effusive, insincere. It was a great mistake to have come. He should have stayed at home and read his book, thought Peter Walsh. Should have gone to a music hall. He should have stayed at home, for he knew no one. Oh dear, it was going to be a failure, a complete failure. Clarissa felt it in her bones, as dear old Lord Lexham stood there apologising for his wife, who had caught cold at the Buckingham Palace garden party. She could see Peter out of the tail of her eye, criticising her, there in that corner. Why, after all, did she do these things? Why seek pinnacles and stand drenched in fire? Might it consume her anyhow, burn her to cinders? Better anything, better brandish one's torch and hurl it to earth than taper and dwindle away like some Ellie Henderson. It was extraordinary how Peter put her into these states just by coming and standing in a corner. He made her see herself, exaggerate. It was idiotic. But why did he come then? Merely to criticise? Why always take, never give? Why not risk one's one little point of view? There he was, wandering off, and she must speak to him. But she'd not get the chance. Life was that. Humiliation. Renunciation. What Lord Lexham was saying was that his wife would not wear her furs at the garden party because, "My dear, you ladies are all alike." Lady Lexham being 75, at least. It was delicious how they petted each other, that old couple. She did like old Lord Lexham. She did think it mattered, her party, and it made her feel quite sick to know that it was all going wrong, all falling flat. Anything, any explosion, any horror was better than people wandering aimlessly, standing in a bunch at a corner like Ellie Henderson, not even caring to hold themselves upright. For it was the middle of June. The war was over, except for someone like Mrs. Foxcroft at the embassy last night, eating her heart out because that nice boy was killed, and now the old manor house must go to a cousin. Or Lady Bexborough, who opened a bazaar, they said, with the telegram in her hand. John, her favourite, killed. But it was over. Thank heaven, over. It was June. The King and Queen were at the palace. And everywhere, though it was still so early, there was a beating, a stirring of galloping ponies, tapping of cricket bats. Lords, Ascot, Ranelagh, and all the rest of it, wrapped in the soft mesh of the grey-blue morning air, which, as the day wore on, would unwind them and set down on their lawns and pitches, the bouncing ponies whose forefeet just struck the ground and up they sprung, the whirling young men and laughing girls in their transparent muslins, who, even now, after dancing all night, were taking their absurd woolly dogs for a run. And even now, at this hour, discreet old dowagers were shooting out in their motor cars on errands of mystery, and the shopkeepers were fidgeting in their windows with their paste and diamonds, their lovely old sea-green brooches in 18th-century settings to tempt Americans. But one must economise, not buy things rashly for Elizabeth. And she, too, loving it as she did with an absurd and faithful passion, being part of it, since her people were courtiers once in the time of the Georges. She, too, was going that very night to kindle and illuminate, to give her party. But how strange, on entering the park, the silence, the mist, the hum, the slow-swimming happy ducks, the pouched birds waddling. And who should be coming along with his back against the government buildings, most appropriately, carrying a dispatch box stamped with the royal arms? Who but Hugh Whitbread, her old friend Hugh, the admirable Hugh? "Good morning to you, Clarissa," said Hugh rather extravagantly, for they had known each other as children. "Where are you off to?" "I love walking in London," said Mrs. Dalloway. "Really, it's better than walking in the country." They had just come up, unfortunately, to see doctors. Other people came to see pictures, go to the opera, take their daughters out. The Whitbreads came to see doctors. Times without number, Clarissa had visited Evelyn Whitbread in a nursing home. Was Evelyn ill again? "Evelyn was a good deal out of sorts," said Hugh, intimating by a kind of pout or swell of his very well-covered, manly, extremely handsome, perfectly upholstered body. He was almost too well-dressed, always, but presumably had to be with his little job at court, that his wife had some internal ailment, nothing serious, which, as an old friend, Clarissa Dalloway would quite understand without requiring him to specify. Ah, yes, she did, of course. What a nuisance! And felt very sisterly, and oddly conscious at the same time of her hat. Not the right hat for the early morning. Was that it? For Hugh always made her feel, as he bustled on, raising his hat rather extravagantly and assuring her that she might be a girl of 18, and of course he was coming to her party tonight, Evelyn absolutely insisted, only a little late he might be after the party at the palace to which she had to take one of Jim's boys. She always felt a little skimpy beside Hugh, schoolgirlish, but attached to him, partly from having known him always. But she did think him a good sort in his own way, though Richard was nearly driven mad by him. And as for Peter Walsh, he had never to this day forgiven her for liking him. She sat on the floor. That was her first impression of Sally. She sat on the floor with her arms round her knees, smoking a cigarette. Where could it have been? The Mannings? The Kinloch Joneses? At some party, where she couldn't be certain, for she had a distinct recollection of saying to the man she was with, "Who is that?" And he had told her, and said that Sally's parents didn't get on. How that shocked her, that one's parents should quarrel. But all that evening she couldn't take her eyes off Sally. It was an extraordinary beauty of the kind she most admired, dark, large-eyed, with that quality which, since she hadn't got it herself, she always envied, a sort of abandonment, as if she could say anything, do anything, a quality much commoner in foreigners than in English women. Sally always said she had French blood in her veins. An ancestor had been with Marie Antoinette, had his head cut off, left a ruby ring. Perhaps that summer she came to stay at Boughton, walking in quite unexpectedly, without a penny in her pocket, one night after dinner, and upsetting poor Aunt Helena to such an extent that she never forgave her. There had been some quarrel at home. She literally hadn't a penny that night when she came to them, had pawned a brooch to come down. She had rushed off in a passion. They sat up till all hours of the night, talking. Sally it was who made her feel, for the first time, how sheltered the life at Boughton was. She knew nothing about sex, nothing about social problems. She had once seen an old man who had dropped dead in a field. She had seen cows just after their calves were born. But Aunt Helena never liked discussion of anything. When Sally gave her William Morris, it had to be wrapped in brown paper. There they sat, hour after hour, talking in her bedroom at the top of the house, talking about life how they were to reform the world. They meant to found a society to abolish private property, and actually had a letter written, though not sent out. The ideas were Sally's, of course. But very soon she was just as excited. Read Plato in bed before breakfast. Read Morris. Read Shelley by the hour. Sally's power was amazing. Her gift. Her personality. There was her way with flowers, for instance. At Boughton they always had stiff little vases all the way down the table. Sally went out, picked hollyhocks, dahlias, all sorts of flowers that had never been seen together, cut their heads off, and made them swim on the top of water in bowls. The effect was extraordinary, coming in to dinner in the sunset. Of course, Aunt Helena thought it wicked to treat flowers like that. Then she forgot her sponge and ran along the passage naked. That grim old housemaid, Ellen Atkins, went about grumbling, "Suppose any of the gentlemen had seen." Indeed, she did shock people. She was untidy, Papa said. The strange thing, on looking back, was the purity, the integrity of her feeling for Sally. It wasn't like one's feeling for a man. It was completely disinterested. And besides, it had a quality which could only exist between women just grown up. It was protective on her side, sprang from a sense of being in league together, a presentiment of something that was bound to part them. They spoke of marriage always as a catastrophe, which led to this chivalry, this protective feeling, which was much more on her side than Sally's. For in those days she was completely reckless, did the most idiotic things out of bravado, bicycled round the parapet on the terrace, smoked cigars. Absurd, she was, very absurd. But the charm was overpowering, to her at least, so that she could remember standing in her bedroom at the top of the house, holding the hot water can in her hands and saying aloud, "She is beneath this roof. She is beneath this roof." He had gone into dinner rather late, from some idiotic idea of making himself felt, and had sat down by old Miss Perry, Aunt Helena, Mr. Parry's sister, who was supposed to preside. There she sat in her white cashmere shawl, with her head against the window. A formidable old lady, but kind to him, for he had found her some rare flower, and she was a great botanist, marching off in thick boots with a black collecting box slung between her shoulders. He sat down beside her and couldn't speak. Everything seemed to race past him. He just sat there, eating. And then, halfway through dinner, he made himself look across at Clarissa for the first time. She was talking to a young man on her right. He had a sudden revelation. "She will marry that man," he said to himself. He didn't even know his name. For, of course, it was that afternoon, that very afternoon, that Dalloway had come over. And Clarissa called him Wickham. That was the beginning of it all. Somebody had brought him over, and Clarissa got his name wrong. She introduced him to everybody as Wickham. At last he said, "My name is Dalloway." That was his first view of Richard, a fair young man, rather awkward, sitting on a deck chair and blurting out, "My name is Dalloway." Sally got hold of it. Always after that she called him, "My name is Dalloway." He was a prey to revelations at that time. This one, that she would marry Dalloway, was blinding, overwhelming at the moment. There was a sort of, how could he put it, a sort of ease in her manner to him, something maternal, something gentle. They were talking about politics. All through dinner he tried to hear what they were saying. Afterwards he could remember standing by old Miss Parry's chair in the drawing-room. Clarissa came up, with her perfect manners, like a real hostess, and wanted to introduce him to someone. Spoke as if they had never met before, which enraged him. Yet, even then, he admired her for it. He admired her courage, her social instinct. He admired her power of carrying things through. "The perfect hostess," he said to her, whereupon she winced all over. But he meant her to feel it. He would have done anything to hurt her after seeing her with Dalloway. So she left